Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The former Black Panther leader Geronimo Gijaga-Pratt died Thursday at the age of 63 in a village in the East African country of Tanzania. In 1972, Pratt was wrongfully convicted of the murder of Carolyn Olson. He spent 27 years in prison, 8 of those in solitary confinement. He was released in 1997 after a Reagan appointee, a judge, vacated his conviction. Geronimo Gijaga-Pratt, his family and supporters always maintained he was targeted and framed by the FBI and the LA Police Department because of his activity in the Black Panther Party. 2 years after his release, Pratt won a $4.5 million settlement of his civil rights case against the FBI and LAPD. The FBI's share of $1.75 million marked one of the few times in its history it was forced to admit culpability in a case of false imprisonment. Geronimo Gijaga-Pratt, born Elmer Pratt, was a Louisiana native, decorated Vietnam vet who served in the Army's 82nd Airborne. Before we turn to our guests, I'd like to play part of a radio interview I did with Geronimo Pratt in 2000, 3 years after he was released from jail. We were also joined in WBAI studios in New York for this conversation by one of Geronimo Gijaga-Pratt's attorneys, Johnny Cochran, who died in 2005.
Well, I grew up in segregation, and we had to deal with the terror from the Klan violence and, you know, other forms of ignorance from those peoples. But growing up in that kind of environment instilled in me a pride of or a sense of nationalism that we can govern ourselves and we can protect ourselves, and we didn't need to be with anyone who didn't want to be with us. So out of that, I was part of a group that was selected by the elders to get military training to come back to the community, you know, and help protect it, relieve the old soldiers. It just so happened that when I was selected, Vietnam was happening, and I ended up in Vietnam and survived that two and a half tours. And when I came back, it was shortly after Martin Luther King was assassinated, so the Black nation was more or less at one now with the just being fed up. And everyone was saying, look, we have to do something. So us young militant types were employed quite extensively throughout the nation. And so this is how I ended up in these cities, contributing what little I could contribute.
And you got involved then with the Black Panther Party?
Well, with various organizations, including the Black Panther Party.
So how did you end up in a courtroom being tried for the murder of Carolyn Olson? She was killed playing on a Santa Monica tennis court with her husband in 1968. Mm-hmm. You were caught and charged when?
Well, I was arrested 2 years after that in 1970 in Dallas, Texas, where I was instrumental in helping to organize the first Black Panther chapter there in Dallas, Texas, and other parts of the South. Sure. I was charged because of a conspiracy by the government that was led by the Hoover, what we call the Hoover-Nixon regime, which was an illegal conspiracy directed against the entire left, entire movement.
Johnny Cochran, how did you get involved with Geronimo's case?
I was appointed by the court by Judge Kathleen Parker to represent Mr. Pratt in the murder case. I had met him and had sat alongside him in another case, the so-called Panther shootout case that took place in 1970-71 in L.A. It was then the longest trial ever. And all the Panthers were pretty much acquitted of all the charges in that, and it was a bogus case. The court then appointed me to represent him in the tennis court murder case.
And what happened in that first trial?
Well, it was an amazing trial. I mean, we came in there knowing and believing strongly that Geronimo Pratt was innocent. We sought to set out to prove that innocence, to establish an alibi. We ran into some problems in getting other Panther members to come and establish the alibi. Mr. Pratt was in Oakland at the time of these killings in December of 1968. None of the Panthers who were affiliated with or align with Huey Newton would come. So Kathleen Cleaver was in exile.
And that was because he had already been expelled from
Mr. Pratt had been expelled, and further, that the FBI had infiltrated him so much that they inculcated this kind of fear and distrust and whatever. They wouldn't let him come testify. So we got Kathleen Cleaver to come back, and she was a great witness. She couldn't pin it down as much as we wanted to, but we still thought we'd won the case. Jury stays out like 12 days or more, and they're hopelessly deadlocked, but they end up convicting an innocent man. And it was all the things we didn't see that took place which caused that defeat. And Mr. Pratt would always say, they're out to get me there. And I would always say, well, what do you mean by they? What do you mean by they? Who is this they? And of course, he was right. And as I said, I learned a lot from representing Mr. Pratt. You know, a little paranoia is healthy, that even paranoid people have real enemies. And of course, he was right, that was they. It was the FBI. It was the counterintelligence program. And Amy, how we found this out was through the good offices, really, of Stuart Hanlon. In the intervening years after the conviction, through the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to find out a number of things. That this man, Julius Butler, who was the star witness for the prosecution, who got on the stand and said that Mr. Pratt confessed to him, and was asked by me, are you now, have you ever been an informant for the FBI or any other agency? And he said no. He said no, unequivocally no. He lied. At that point, he said that he'd informed 33 times. And in fact, he was an informant for the LAPD and the LA County DA's office. He was their confidential informant. They'd done that. They had wiretapped our phones. They had had informants in the defense environs, that meaning that somewhere in our offices they knew everything we're going to do. They had failed to give us Brady material, that is exculpatory material, where the husband of this lady who was shot had positively identified two other people. They kept that from us. They did all these things in an effort to neutralize, which meant kill, destroy, lock up forever, Geronimo Pratt at the behest of the J. Edgar Hoover.
Geronimo, before you were set free, 26 years and 7 months after you went to prison, you were in solitary for 8 years.
Yes.
We can say that, but what does that mean? What is life like in solitary? Where were you kept?
Well, I was kept in the hole in San Quentin and Folsom. I started in a hole in Dallas, Texas, where I was busted. And then on to the holes in Los Angeles County Jail, which is like nightmares when you're talking about the holes in Texas and L.A. County, the old county jail. And then on to the holes in state prisons. But what it means is that this country tortures people. And right now, Hugo Pinnell is going into his 27th year in the hole. Woodfox and Wallace and King, who are in Angola State Prison in Louisiana, going into their 23rd year in the hole. So when you talk about 8 years in the hole, and you look at this ongoing today, it's hard for me to even talk about those 8 years because it's happening right now.
How many hours a day are you kept in this single cell?
24 hours a day. And then after the second year, it became 23 and a half. They would let you out for a half an hour.
To those who say that the system has proved that it works by ultimately you being exonerated, what do you say?
I'll say that's not a... That's the evidence to the contrary, that it doesn't work too well. All of my 7 years of my 20s, every minute of my 30s, every second of my 40s were taken away from me. If that's a system working, then I think something wrong with your thinking.
Geronimo G. Jaga, born Elmer Pratt, speaking in the studios of WBAI with Juan Gonzalez and me, along with one of his attorneys, the late Johnny Cochran. Yes, Johnny Cochran of OJ fame, said that this case, the case of Geronimo G. Jaga, was the most important of his life, and the happiest day was the day that he was released. Also in that studio that day, and joining us today from San Francisco, is Geronimo G. Jaga's friend and former attorney, Stuart Hanlon. Hanlon's a criminal lawyer who began working on Pratt's case when he was a law student and stayed for 23 years until Pratt won his freedom in 97. And we're joined on the phone from Los Angeles by Ed Boyer, who began writing about Pratt's case in the early 90s for the Los Angeles Times, where he was a reporter for 20 years, now retired. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Stuart Hanlon, let's go to you first. The news of the death of Geronimo G. Jaga, you remained his friend to the end. He died in Tanzania. He was living there?
Right. He died. He'd left about 3 weeks before from Louisiana, and he had a great trip out here in California, and he seemed terrific. And it was a real shock, obviously. He just had such a great time when he was out in California with his daughter, seeing me and some other people. But, you know, life is short.
Well, first, our condolences to you and to his family who he's living with in Tanzania. In a nutshell, describe this case, and especially for young people, describe what COINTELPRO is, the counterintelligence program, and how a Reagan-appointed attorney, a Reagan-appointed judge, ultimately overturned the conviction of Geronimo G. Jaga, the jury never having known that the person who pointed the finger at Geronimo G. Jaga falsely was a police and FBI informant.
I think the place to start is the question that you guys asked Geronimo years ago. Do you think it proves the system works because you won? And Johnny at one point, it's one of the few differences he and I had, and he said the same system that locked up Geronimo let him free. Well, the system doesn't work. And if it took, as Geronimo pointed out, it took 27 years of his life to free an innocent man. And what people should understand, and which I think we kind of understood back then, but not to the extent it was proven, is that our government, and you say government because it is the FBI with the president, local law enforcement in Los Angeles, district attorneys, conspire to convict somebody and lock them up and have them face a death penalty because of their political beliefs and affiliations. It's that back in the 60s and early 70s, the Panthers were considered by J. Edgar Hoover and many others, especially in the white community, as the number one threat to the safety of America. And imagine that we felt that a group of young African Americans, probably less than 1,000 throughout the country, were the number one threat to our internal safety. And because of that, these law enforcement people and judges and district attorneys felt that the ends justified the means to get rid of them by any means necessary. And we've learned that Fred Hampton was murdered, another Panther, in Chicago, and Geronimo was framed. And people say, how do you know it was framed? It was just some technicality. And I think the best image is that Julio Butler was asked by Johnny on a number of occasions, were you an informant for any agency? And he said over and over, no. And as it turned out, and I think what got Judge Dickey, is that he was an informant not just for the FBI, but for the LA Police Department, and finally for the LA District Attorney's Office. And these three agencies sat in court, because the FBI was there, and let this man lie and commit perjury to convict somebody. That's not a technicality. That's the breakdown. This, what does it say to people today, young people like Geronimo and I were 40-some years ago, and even Johnny was pretty young back then, that paranoia is healthy, that now our new enemy may not be the Black Panther Party or African-American groups, but the new enemy could be Mid-Eastern people or Muslims. And we demonize them as the Panthers were demonized, and then we justify trials without juries, trial without, in military courts. We justify, setting up military courts in Cuba, in Guantanamo. And we justify all these things in the name of protecting our country. And what we don't understand is our country falls apart when we do these things. And the legal system falls apart when we let these things happen. And that's the ultimate, not personal story of Geronimo, but the political story, I think.
One of the remarkable things is that the FBI was so closely monitoring Elmer Pratt, Geronimo G. Jaga, as leader of the Black Panther, one of the leaders of the Black Panther movement, that they had repeated wiretaps of him. They knew where he was, didn't they? That night, for example, when Carolyn Olson was killed on the tennis court, this young woman who with her husband had gone to play tennis?
Well, we were at Geronimo when he was here. He and I were looking through old boxes of COINTELPRO documents. There were thousands and thousands just on his case. And I was just recently, after Geronimo died, talked to an investigator who first found the wiretaps. Investigators and an ex-FBI agent, Wesley Swearingen, found the wiretaps, and by the time we got to the case, they had been destroyed. But the FBI followed Geronimo every second almost of his life, and they knew he was in Oakland at the time of the homicide. And when we started litigating this, rather than turning it over, for the first time any could remember, FBI wiretaps disappeared. And of course they knew where he was. It didn't matter what the truth was, you see, because he was the bad guy. And the truth had to take second place, even in the courtroom. But yeah, I mean, they certainly knew where he was, and they knew what he was about, and did many other Panthers. I mean, they knew where they all were. It was amazing the amount of time, money, and effort was put into monitoring this small group of political activists.
We're also, in addition to Stuart Hanlon, joined by Ed Boyer, longtime Los Angeles Times reporter, now retired, but he did write the piece on Geronimo Gigiago when he died on Thursday. Ed, talk about how you first came to the story. Your reporting was instrumental, ultimately, in having Geronimo Gigiago exonerated and freed.
Well, Amy, I saw a very short story in the LA Times towards the end of a week, pointing out that Jim McCloskey, who runs Centurion Ministries, was getting involved and investigating the case. And that was my first entree, because McCloskey had just had a successful case in Los Angeles County. Clarence Chance and I believe Benny Powell, they were released after 17 years in prison. So I began reading our old clips, and what I found amazing was that going back to 1979, from Freedom of Information requests, they turned up all of this evidence showing that Julius Butler had been an informant. And during Geronimo's original trial, his prosecutor said, "This case boils down to, does the jury believe Julius Butler? If they believe Butler, the case is over." So they built their whole case around Butler, and less than 7 years afterwards, there was all this Freedom of Information material showing that Butler had lied that long ago. And that's when I began reporting. And it was stunning to me to learn that Butler was chairman of the board of one of the most prominent and one of the most outstanding African-American congregations in Los Angeles, First AME Church. So I began my reporting there.
And talk about what you uncovered through this period and how ultimately Geronimo Gigiago was freed.
Well, I think he was ultimately freed because of Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran, the very people who had run him as an informant, sat there during the habeas corpus hearing and pointed out, yes, he was my informant in this circumstance. They detailed chapter and verse how he had been their informant. There was no getting around it at that point. But I just continued to report. I found one of the original jurors who told me that had she and at least two other jurors, had they known that this guy was an informant, they never would have voted for a conviction. And the thing that turned them, however, was that there was this odd situation with the Polaroid photograph. I talked to Cochran about this, and Stuart probably talked to him more than I did, that this photograph was kind of throwaway evidence. The witnesses had described Pratt described the shooter, rather, as clean-shaven, but Pratt had always had a goatee. And towards the end of the trial, my understanding is Johnny introduced this Polaroid photo of him with a goatee, and he could not have grown that between the time of the murder in December of 68 and Christmas of 68 when the photo was taken. The prosecution came right back with an expert from Polaroid saying the film used in this photograph was not even available until some 6 months later. And that was very damaging, according to the juror I spoke to. But I just continued to find people who were involved, continue reporting the story, whatever little leads I could. I mean, this is how I met Stuart Hanlon. And I got an education from him, of course.
Stuart Hanlon, can you talk about the judge who ultimately overturned the conviction?
Judge Dickey, you know, we were in Los Angeles, a bunch of lawyers. It was Johnny and me and a bunch of other people, Mark Rosenbaum of the ACLU, Julie Drouse in San Francisco, Robert Garcia. It was a lot, and we were thought we'd get a liberal judge in L.A. And the whole judge, the whole bench recused themselves because they said we can't hear the case because the ex-DA who we were attacking was now a judge. So we got sent to Orange County, and everybody said, oh, you're behind the orange curtain. You're finished. We're going to get, and then we get this Republican judge appointed by Reagan, and we thought we were over. And what we didn't understand is we found a true conservative who believed in the Constitution. And every time we walked into court, we had a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, which was unusual in courthouses at that point. But it set a tone of we were going to follow the rules. And I think he was really moved by the evidence. I think Johnny Cochran had an incredible presence in that courtroom. And Judge Dickey was offended at the deepest place that a good judge can be at how justice was turned on his head. The things Ed was talking about, that these cops came in and this young investigator came in for the DA, and they proved Butler was an informant. I mean, the DA said, the judge said, I didn't know this judge, Richard Kalustian, who was the DA. And then this young investigator came in and said, here's our informant file from 1970. And Julio's Butler, I found it by looking under B. And you could see in the courtroom how it just fell apart. And it wasn't just Butler. There were so many other things that showed Pratt was innocent. But by the end, I was watching last night a video of Geronimo getting bail, and Johnny said, how about $1,000 for each year? Let's set it at $25,000. And Judge Dickey literally had tears in his eyes when he granted it. He was moved by Geronimo, this ex-Vietnam vet, and the proof that he was framed by the country Dickey believed in. I think it shook the judge to his core to see what had occurred. I just want to say one thing, Amy, in terms of what Ed did. It was amazing. The media, Ed and another reporter for the Times before Ed, Austin Scott, they made this a national story. You know, they made this something that couldn't go away. And you know, the power of the press and what Ed Boyer did and Austin Scott was truly amazing in moving Geronimo's case forward.
And Johnny Cochran, of course, who was known by everyone for representing O.J. Simpson, said it was this case that was his most important case, that he would not rest until Geronimo Gigiago was free. Why was this so important to Johnny? He was his court-appointed attorney, is that right?
Because Johnny, you know, through all the fancy suits and ties and O.J., was ultimately a man who truly believed in justice. And I got to know him really well in this case. And Johnny, as a DA, he was a DA for about 4 years under Vandekamp, would always write parole letters for Geronimo on DA stationery and got in trouble. He believed Geronimo was innocent, and that meant so much to him. And he always said, and it was true, this case meant so much more to him than any other case. And one of the really amazing sights at Johnny's funeral, there were so many dignitaries, and dignitaries is the wrong word, but so many well-known people, and everybody wanted to hear one person speak. And you know, Johnny, wherever he was, did too, and that was Geronimo Pratt. And Geronimo was eloquent, and he was a key speaker at Johnny's funeral because those two were joined at the hip, not only coming from Louisiana, but as African-American men and their search for justice from different directions. Johnny, it was the happiest day I ever saw all of us when Geronimo walked out of prison.
And we're going to go to that moment. Stuart Hanlon, thanks so much for being with us, and thank you to Ed Boyer for all of your work and for being with us this morning, a retired Los Angeles Times reporter. As we turn now to that day, June 10th, 1997, amidst loud cheers from his family and supporters, former Black Panther Geronimo Gigiago Pratt walking out of a Santa Monica, California courtroom after a judge released him on $25,000 bail just 12 days after reversing his 1972 murder conviction. This came with an audio report from KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Geronimo Gigiago Pratt speaking upon his release.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your fair and courageous ruling and assure you that any further proceedings in this case, I'll be the first one here. because I've been trying to resolve the merits of this case for all of these years to find out who killed Mrs. Olson, not any technicalities to try to put it off. And I am so happy that you've given me this chance to finally expose the truth about who killed Mrs. Olson. And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
That was Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, June 10th, 1997, when he was freed by a California judge after serving more than a quarter of a century in prison. He died at the age of 63 in Tanzania last Thursday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.